Please be seated. Marina McCoy received her doctorate in philosophy from Boston University in 1997 and is presently the holder of the Albert J. Fitzgibbons Chair in Philosophy at Boston College. She is the author of a book entitled Plato on the Rhetoric of Philosophers and Sophists, and is currently working on a book on the themes of vulnerability and suffering in Greek philosophy and literature. Tonight she will speak to us on pity as a civic virtue in Sophocles' Philoctetes. Please welcome Professor McCoy.
Thank you for having me here. It's a real pleasure to be here in the intellectual community at St. John's. I was just saying to a couple of the tutors beforehand how nice it is to be in an audience of people who've read the Philoctetes, since unnamed people in my own field have not always done so. So thanks for having me here. The Philoctetes does not open with its main character, because at the start of the play, no dialogue is possible for him. The first word of the dialogue in Greek is akte, or shore, an appropriate beginning since Philoctetes himself belongs to the periphery, the edge, the space in between belonging to society, to which he naturally as a human being forms a part, and being an island to himself in his isolation on Lemnos. Lemnos is a large island west of Troy, and so it is somewhat surprising when Odysseus describes it as completely uninhabited, a place that no one even visits. Because of this isolation, we find Philoctetes to be someone in a place that is in between. Physically, he is entirely separated from his fellow comrades at arms, with whom he willingly went to fight at Troy. He lacks the ability to speak with any other human being, to communicate. He is also excluded from the company of the gods, insofar as his treading on the sacred ground of Chryses, en route to Troy, is the cause of his oozing wound and the ground of his subsequent exclusion from the company of his own men. At the same time, we know Philoctetes to be by nature a social man. While Odysseus himself is said to have feigned madness in order to avoid the war, Philoctetes went willingly, bringing seven armies with him. His bow and subsequent military power, so highly sought after by Odysseus in his final year at Troy, are the result of a gift of Heracles. When Heracles desires to die to escape the intolerable pain of his poison cloak, it is Philoctetes who willingly sets the fire to the pyre after others refuse, allowing Heracles to escape his pain. Although he is severely wounded, Philoctetes' empty cave nonetheless contains traces of civilization: a crudely carved wooden cup, a bed made of leaves, material for making a fire, and especially Philoctetes' bow, which allows him to slay birds and to survive off of their meat. While isolated from the materiality and sociality of civilization, Philoctetes nonetheless endeavors to live a distinctively human life. The shore is thus an image of Philoctetes himself, as not only in between island and world, but also as representative of someone who is located in between isolation and society, between brutishness and culture, between nature and civilization. Sophocles presents not only Philoctetes' physical wounds, but also his existence in this in-between space as that which grants him access into humanity in a special way possible for those at the margins. As a marginal figure, he belongs both to the human and to the inhuman. As the shore is both sea and sand, Philoctetes is both social because human, and yet denied the social connections that he craves. But what is important about Philoctetes is not only the fact of his wound. Surely his extreme physical pain matters to him, and at times occupies his attention to the exclusion of many other things. But even for Philoctetes, this wound is only a figure of much deeper wounds, suffered in his exclusion from society, from the company of other fellow human beings. He knows his need for society precisely through its being denied to him. Philoctetes eventually gains a deeper access to his humanity precisely through others' denial of it. His experience of longing for others opens him up to a deeper understanding of his own nature by virtue of his lack. And it is this longing and need that lead another, Neoptolemus, to his own growth in the political community. The vulnerable and wounded are not merely to be tolerated or accepted. Rather, Sophocles presents Philoctetes' weakness as contributing to the growth of Neoptolemus' virtue, and to the growth of the political community. Odysseus initially describes Philoctetes to Neoptolemus primarily as one who cries, who makes noise. He claims that Philoctetes was abandoned because his savage cries and ill-omened words kept interrupting sacrifices. Indeed, the chorus and Neoptolemus discover Philoctetes by his constant cries, so that we might expect to find a wild man or a savage in that first encounter. But instead of wildness, we find something else entirely. Philoctetes' first sounds, once he encounters men again, are not screams, but a speech. In fact, he gives a speech about speeches. Philoctetes pleads that the others speak to him. He's especially hopeful from their attire that it will be in Greek, which he can understand, because primary to his own healing is communication. He says, "Strangers, xenoi, who are you? Who are you that with the sailor's oar have landed here without good mooring or inhabitants? Of what homeland are you? What family might I chance to say? The style of your clothing is Greek, always beloved to me. I want to hear your voice. Don't shrink in dread from my wildness, but pity me, a man, miserable, alone, abandoned, friendless. Speak if you have arrived in friendship. Answer me, for it is not reasonable that I should miss this from you or you from me." Philoctetes asks a whole series of questions, questions that demand answers, and whose answers demand an expression of identity, the speaker's home, ethnicity, language, and whether their presence is one of friendship or not. Every one of these first questions posed by Philoctetes expresses the need for society in both content and in form. The content concerns the social nexus into which his visitors belong, and whether Philoctetes in some way belongs to that same nexus as Greek or friend. But the form of speaking itself is for Philoctetes already connective, and his question as a question is connective, or at least desirous of connection. Questions are speech acts that embody longing of some sort, whether the longing for an answer to a problematic philosophical question or the longing for the contact of speech itself. A question is an invitation to another person to offer some kind of an answer. A question is an expression of not yet having what one desires, of lack or of need. Philoctetes is a needy man and is far past the point of denying his neediness. For him, that they would somehow miss one another, and he uses the word there, hamartain, is beyond what is reasonable for a man to endure. His use of hamartain here gives us the sense that it would be almost a moral or a religious failing. When Neoptolemus offers the briefest of answers, "Stranger, know first that we are Greeks," Philoctetes makes no effort to hide his joy in finding this moment of connection, exclaiming, "What beloved sound, alas, to receive an address from such a man after such a long time." The sound of the Greek is a beloved experience for him because of the fellowship that it offers, the possibility of meaningful exchange, the experience of gift and giver, of reception and recipient, making a return of the gift of the word, each in reply. Philoctetes is deeply aware of the giftedness of these words, giftedness of logos, almost exuberant with its joy. Philoctetes' eager desire for speech is matched only by Neoptolemus' hesitance to engage in speech, a hesitancy that we can fairly attribute to two causes. First, Odysseus has warned Neoptolemus that Philoctetes may be resentful of Odysseus or anyone associated with him. The image he has conveyed to Neoptolemus is to be careful not to be shot at with a powerful bow. And second, Neoptolemus has been sent by Odysseus to use deceitful speech to trick Philoctetes into handing over the bow. But Neoptolemus from the beginning finds such a use of speech to lack nobility and goodness. He's most hesitant to begin speaking because of the possibility that the words may be used for deception and not friendship, to steal rather than to make a gift. We find then in these earliest exchanges between Philoctetes and Neoptolemus a kind of prefiguring of a choice Neoptolemus himself will have to make about the proper use of speech in response to his encounter with Philoctetes' woundedness. Speech, especially persuasive speech, will be a central topic of the play, and here we see the necessity of speech for a human being at its most elemental. At its most basic level here, speech presumes contact, and the play's concern centers around two interrelated issues. First, the narrower issue as to whether false persuasive speech for the sake of a just goal, such as the defeat of Troy, is an acceptable means to the end, and second, the broader issue as to what speech ought to communicate. For Neoptolemus, his own development is to regard speech not only as a means of effecting action, but more importantly, as a communication of the self, or of two selves to one another. Neoptolemus's window into the need of speech to be interpersonal, an authentic communication of one person to another, arises eventually from his contact with one who has been so long deprived of such communication. It is Philoctetes' lack that will expose his neediness for communication to Neoptolemus, and so also communicates a larger truth about speech to the youth. Neoptolemus learns that speech is that which connects persons, and is not only a means of accomplishing goals, as Odysseus would have it. To this extent, Neoptolemus preserves his natural inclination towards speech that is measured by virtue rather than political efficacy. His encounter with Philoctetes reinforces his understanding of justice and virtue as central to good speech. Philoctetes' need, even his pain, assists Neoptolemus in growing in his understanding of speech as requiring a care for virtue. Neoptolemus' sympathy for Philoctetes allows him to resist an understanding of speech oriented exclusively toward political efficacy, instead moving him to understand speech as oriented toward building political community and friendship. When Neoptolemus feigns ignorance of Philoctetes' story, Philoctetes seeks to communicate it. His self-understanding is not merely that he is wounded. He also says that his comrades abandoned him. To be sure, Philoctetes' wound itself is painful, but his suffering comes from his understanding of himself as abandoned, desolate, left alone, with no one to witness the pain, let alone to share in it with him, even through a minimal act of sympathy. This idea of being known, his pain being witnessed, is apparent in his deep disappointment that Neoptolemus has not even heard his story. Part of the suffering, to be sure, is simply the absence of human contact, and his sorrow that he has not even missed enough for stories to be told about him. But the suffering from abandonment in this case is worse, for the very reason for his abandonment it was that his pain was too much for the other Greeks to bear. It was for them an interruption, a disturbance of their senses of smell and sound. However, perhaps his cries also disrupted the others precisely because they did call forth a certain kind of shared feeling, a feeling with Philoctetes of extreme discomfort that could not be ignored or be put away except by putting him away. So while Philoctetes is in pain, he suffers less from the wounded leg than from the wounds of rejection, from the judgment and evaluation that his pain is too much to bear, that the community will not bear his pain along with him. Philoctetes becomes identified not as a man who has pain, but in a sense as pain, as the one who cries and disturbs the order. His identity becomes submerged in his becoming the wounded one, when for Philoctetes, he is himself still a Greek, a warrior, the one who mastered the bow of Heracles, the one who was willing to fight for his fellow men. He does not wish to be defined entirely by his pain, but ironically, in being cast out from society, he is left with little else except for it. Philoctetes survives just barely because he is able to crawl out and to find food, to hunt with the bow, and to create fire. He says, "When there was no fire, striking stone against stone, I bring to light the hidden spark which always saved me." Philoctetes' two technologies available to him are fire and the bow. These are his only bridge to civilization, as well as his means of survival, when deprived of the culture and society of others. In Sophocles' Greece, when a new colony was founded, a symbolic fire was taken from the public hearth of the Prytaneum to the new city and used to light its hearth. In light of this Attic tradition, we might imagine the importance of fire in the Greek understanding of a public space. Philoctetes has a private fire, which he must strike anew each time, so he is deprived of the public hearth, the fire of the city that burns for the whole community and not only for our private home. Heracles' bow is also representative of Philoctetes' middle place between solitary existence and civilization, for its original purpose was for use in the Trojan War. As such, his bow was intended to serve him as a warrior and ally in the Greek agreement to defend the guest-host relationship. On the isolated island, however, Philoctetes' bow is diminished to an instrument that can bring him food. Instead of fighting Trojans, he is killing birds. His bow was also his last remaining vestige of his power. It is the sole reason that Odysseus returns for Philoctetes and wishes to bring him back. The bow soon also becomes a sign of friendship between Neoptolemus and Philoctetes, when the latter allows the young man to hold it and even to protect it as a sign of his trust in their bond. Rather quickly into their conversation, Philoctetes receives the experience of connection and of empathy that he desires, but in the form of a deception. Neoptolemus seeks to gain Philoctetes' trust and confidence by suggesting that they share a common enemy among the leaders of Troy. He tells the story of how Odysseus denied him the armor that had belonged to his father, Achilles, and emphasizes his own anger at Odysseus' lack of honor. The psychological aim of such a story is to ally himself with the wounded man through a kind of reverse empathy. Neoptolemus presents himself as one with whom Philoctetes can sympathize. He presents himself as if he were the one in need. So rather than directly sympathizing with Philoctetes, Neoptolemus engages him by drawing him into his own false story. Philoctetes can identify with the story insofar as he can see himself or aspects of himself within it. Thus, in this act of sympathizing with the false Neoptolemus, Philoctetes is in a way sympathizing with himself. His own pain is put on display for him, albeit in a modified and mediated form. He is both the suffering one and the one witnessing the suffering, through this story of anguish similar to his being placed before him in the story of Neoptolemus. Through the other's narrative, he can understand something of his own suffering and find relief in its being shared by another. Thus, the tragedy exhibits for us the ways in which the witnessing to pain and sharing in it through narrative to some extent lighten its load for those who suffer and can even draw them into mutual fellowship. Such mediation and sharing of suffering is also key to the audience experience of tragedy, an experience that makes possible sympathy not only between audience and characters, but perhaps also between members of the audience. Neoptolemus' account of his suffering resonates with Philoctetes. The most obvious resonance rests upon their shared sense of anger at Odysseus, who is supposedly responsible for denying him his father's armor to his son, a typical gift for a son after his father's death. But his story also sets forth other elements present in Philoctetes' life. Neoptolemus feels the loss of his father and a separation from the one he loves, as does Philoctetes feel the separation from his people. Odysseus has told Neoptolemus that the reason he may not have Achilles' armor is, "You are not with us, but instead you were somewhere else and you shouldn't have been." But this sentence also articulates perfectly Philoctetes' perception of his own situation with respect to Troy, that he cannot share in the glory of war because he is somewhere else and he should not be. Just as in Homer, Odysseus is an Udys, nothing, no one, on the island of the Cyclops, when denied the presence of a civilized community, Philoctetes can see his own location only as somewhere else. He is nowhere and somewhere all at once. Philoctetes begs Neoptolemus not to leave him by making himself a suppliant. In asking a question, a person makes himself vulnerable to another person in admitting a need for something he lacks. Supplication is an even more intensive expression of lack or need. The Greek verb for supplication, hiketeuo, is specific to a ritualized set of practices that place a supplicant into relation to the one whom he supplicates. And the act of supplication is not a single act, but, as one author, Niden, has implied, is a four-part process. So a supplicant typically will first approach a person or a place, second, gesture in some way to indicate supplication, for example, kneeling or grasping the knees of another while kneeling. Third, verbally ask for a specific act. And fourth, be responded to. So supplication is an inherently social act that requires give and take. The first three steps depend on the needy one, but the last step is always in the hands of one who is being asked. Here, Philoctetes supplicates not only to get the goal he wants, to leave Lemnos, but also to continue social interaction. The supplication itself assures him that he will not be alone so long as the conversation and the connection continue. His supplication is an expression of his desire for home and of his loneliness and dreading the possibility of yet another abandonment. In kneeling or grasping the knees of another, a supplicant makes himself vulnerable to the other by displaying in physical posture his weakness compared to the one he is approaching. Kneeling or lowering oneself expresses one's lower station, but also makes one vulnerable to attack from above. His verbal request, accompanied by the physical gesture, is desperate. He explicitly asks Neoptolemus to take pity, eleison, on him. At other times, Philoctetes uses the term oiktos for pity. Oiktos might be better rendered as something like pity grief. It's a combination of grief and pity. Now, Constant's book on the nature of pity, David Constant's book on the nature of pity in Greek and Rome, briefly attends to the Philoctetes and gives a very nice analysis of the Aristotelian concept of pity that I wanted to share here. Constant points out that Aristotle requires vulnerability to suffering as a condition of pity. Aristotle writes, there are two sorts of people who are unlikely to feel pity. Those who have lost everything, because they are not likely to feel the possibility of losing anything more, and those who are extremely fortunate, because they are not likely to believe they might suffer the same sort of experience as the one who is now suffering. This is from the Rhetoric, Book 2. In other words, Aristotle makes as a condition of experiencing pity my ability to identify myself as capable of being in the same or similar situation. On the one hand, to have pity for another requires that we have different current fortunes. If we are both sharing the same affliction, it's not pity, but something more like commiseration. On the other hand, I need to be able to imagine myself into the position in which you are. For this reason, Aristotle suggests that most often, we are most capable of pity for those who are more like us in age, station in life, or in character. We must also understand ourselves as vulnerable, and so as like the other who asks for our pity. At the same time, pity is distinct from sympathy, in which the emotion is more closely shared between two people. Constant points out that fairly consistently in Greek literature, the term pity or eleos is excluded from reference to family members' feelings for one another or for the emotions of friends who witness one another's suffering. Pity requires a certain amount of emotional distance, a continued stance of being a bit of an observer on the outside in the Greek sensibility in most literature, while sympathy, sympathia is a term that arises only after the classical period, where other terms such as synalgein, to feel pain with, or sulapesthai, to feel pain or grieve with, connote a deeper sharing of the experience that we might expect in friendship or in familial relationships. We might ask then what allows Neoptolemus to take pity on Philoctetes. What in his character, experience, or his disposition opens up the possibility of pity that also moves him to action when Philoctetes' comrades had abandoned him as a reaction to his wound and to his cries? Of course, Neoptolemus and Odysseus have come for the bow so that the Trojan War might be won. However much this is part of Neoptolemus' own initial motivation and is a reluctant agreement that they must deceive Philoctetes, eventually the better part of Neoptolemus wins out. The part of Neoptolemus that understands good speech to be virtuous and not only politically effective. Good speech in this case means being responsive to Philoctetes as a man, not only as the possessor of the bow. That is, Neoptolemus understands Philoctetes' dignity as a human being to be more significant than his status as the possessor of the weapon that must be had in order to win Troy. This use of the character of Neoptolemus as the one sent to retrieve Philoctetes is a Sophoclean innovation. While little is known of the Aeschylean and Euripidean versions of the play, which haven't survived, except in a critical essay by Dio, we do know that Sophocles alone has Neoptolemus, rather than Odysseus, be Philoctetes' primary relationship on Lemnos. This dramatic innovation allows Sophocles to explore the significance of natural sympathy between human beings as the ground for a political bond. Neoptolemus has no direct connection to Philoctetes apart from being a Greek of noble class, and yet his interpersonal bond to Philoctetes is profound as a result of their mutual encounter with his pain. The turning point for Neoptolemus seems to be neither entreaties to be pious, nor the praise of good character heaped upon him, not even Philoctetes' claim that Neoptolemus is a friend, philos, although that language is used repeatedly throughout the Philoctetes, language of philia and philos. But we might imagine these words prepare the ground for Neoptolemus' renunciation of his deceitful rhetoric. But Philoctetes' cries of pain during an especially acute episode of suffering deeply affect Neoptolemus. As Philoctetes cries out for both relief from the pain and protection for his sacred bow, Neoptolemus exclaims that he feels Philoctetes' pain along with him and has been concerned for his trouble the whole time. In the midst of this pain, Philoctetes begs Neoptolemus to light a fire to burn him so that he might escape his pain. This is just what Philoctetes had once done for Heracles. While Neoptolemus ignores this request, he does give his oath that he will wait and will not leave without Philoctetes. When the wounded man falls asleep, Neoptolemus is faced with the possibility of recapitulating the previous episode in which Odysseus and his men abandoned him on the island while he slept. While the chorus suggests this is the most advantageous time for a clean getaway, now that he has the bow in hand, Neoptolemus remains. His reason is, I see that the hunt for the bow is in vain if we sail without him. For he is the one with the garland, the one that the god told us to bring back. Philoctetes' suffering produces a clear decision on Neoptolemus' part to bring back not only the bow, but also the man. His increased understanding of Philoctetes as a human being whose dignity must be respected, lest he deserve shame and disgrace, stems from an emotional and not simply purely rational encounter with the man. That is, Sophocles presents this young man's moral growth and his understanding of the right moral action to take with Philoctetes as stemming in part from a proper affective response, pity, to a suffering man. While Neoptolemus from the beginning suggests that it is not in his nature to plot against others, his nature, his phusis, is only developed and brought to fruition through an encounter with the one who suffers. He also must reconcile Odysseus's claim that the oracle demands the return of Philoctetes with the question of the man's freedom. That is, he must also try to understand piety, eusebia, better. Thus, the political problem of how to get Philoctetes back into the community, back to Troy, so that the Greeks may be victorious, also requires an interpersonal and sympathetic account that allows Neoptolemus to grow morally. Such moral growth includes a proper affective as well as rational component. Indeed, one might say that for Sophocles, this experience of moral pity unifies the affective and the rational, insofar as pity includes both feelings of concern and the rational judgment that such concern is legitimate in this particular circumstance. Philoctetes is simply overjoyed that he awoke to find himself still surrounded by others, but Neoptolemus expresses confusion, disgust, even pain in trying to discern what next to choose. Neoptolemus even uses the term papai, the same exclamation Philoctetes had used earlier when he was in pain, these long strings of papai that Philoctetes uses, suggesting that Neoptolemus' pain over his moral failing in some way closely mirrors the physical pain that Philoctetes had experienced. That pain exhibits itself as much more than regret or worry, but rather as taking on a physical and almost gut-wrenching quality in his articulation of it. Neoptolemus explains, it's not that I'm leaving you, but rather that I'm sending you somewhere that will cause you distress. That's what's been grieving me for so long. His own agony is understandable, for Neoptolemus must consider not only the justice and nobility of his actions towards Philoctetes, but also this question of piety. After all, Odysseus has argued that piety demands obeying the oracle. At the same time, Odysseus' sense of piety seems to be subservient to his sense of glory and victory. It is Neoptolemus who is left struggling how to reconcile multiple demands of piety and pity, nobility and political obedience. Philoctetes understandably feels betrayed, and he demands the return of his bow. Here we especially see how the bow has taken on the significance of a sign of friendship between them. Just as Heracles had offered it to Philoctetes, not only as a reward for his relief from pain, but also as a sign of their connection to one another, Philoctetes had allowed Neoptolemus to touch it as a sign of their friendship, a connection which had relieved much of the wounded man's pain of isolation. The bow has become not only Philoctetes' only way to survive, more significantly, it is a sign of his honor and his strength. Traditionally, Heracles himself received the bow from Athena. This bow, then, is also a sign of the friendship between the gods and human beings. but Philoctetes' frequent expressions of doubt as to the justice and the care of the gods for him suggest his bow may be one of the last concrete signs of that divine human care that he can recall. In choosing to hand over this bow to Neoptolemus, then, he makes himself much more vulnerable than he had been before. In feeling betrayed in his moment of trust and vulnerability, he demands that the main sign of his vulnerable friendship with Neoptolemus be returned to him. Philoctetes' reaction to the betrayal is understandable, for while Philoctetes could have chosen differently, out of his great need and loneliness, he chose to open himself in friendship to Neoptolemus. One might imagine, for example, an alternative story of a man abandoned on an island because of his wound, who grows to hate others, to reject humanity in others, perhaps even in himself, as a result of the rejection he had experienced. Or imagine if Philoctetes, after 10 years, turned entirely to non-human concerns, perhaps separating himself from his humanity through a kind of reserved asceticism. Philoctetes might reasonably have been distrustful of the strangers who arrived on his island, assuming that these human beings too would only bring him harm. But instead, in Sophocles' version, Philoctetes lays himself bare to them in his need, hiding none of his suffering, neither his physical pain nor his great desire for friendship, community, and truth. Sophocles presents Philoctetes as far more willingly vulnerable than in the Euripidean version of the play, in which Dio tells us Philoctetes' first response to Odysseus' arrival and proclamation that he is a Greek is that he'll shoot any Greek he meets with a bow. This Philoctetes is aware of the dangers, but he is willing to encounter them. He chooses to react to his pain by willingly staying with his neediness and vulnerability, entrusting Neoptolemus after Odysseus' prior betrayal, only to find that the two of them have been deceiving him all along. In this play, Philoctetes repeatedly uses language that indicates he feels a fatherly connection to Neoptolemus, whom he speaks of in terms that might be used of as a son. Through much of the play, Philoctetes calls him Paid or Technon. More than 52 times in all, he uses some kind of term that indicates he is in relationship as a son to a father. So it is no wonder that Philoctetes says that Neoptolemus is taking his life and that he is, quote, nothing, just the ill-fated one. Philoctetes had used his very last strength to decide to engage openly and wholeheartedly with those who promised him relief, only to find that Neoptolemus's treasured words were only lies. Philoctetes wishes to curse Neoptolemus, but even here a kind-heartedness inherent in the man overcomes his sense of victimhood, as he says, curse you, but not yet, before I learn whether you might again change your mind. His desire for goodness in Neoptolemus, for goodness in the humanity that Neoptolemus has come to represent, is so strong that even now he awaits a change of heart on the youth's part. Neoptolemus does not disappoint, and the young man is remarkably open in discussing his own feelings of pity, confusion, and oppression. Philoctetes consoles him, suggesting that perhaps Neoptolemus is not a bad person, but has been taught by evil men. Philoctetes asks for the peaceful return of the bow and just to be left alone. At this moment, Odysseus appears unmoved and inflexible in his demand that both the bow and Philoctetes come with him. Philoctetes releases all of his anger on Odysseus, challenging him for his reasons for abandonment, because now that it serves his purposes, it seems that his cries and the smell of his wound are no longer reasons for separation. Philoctetes curses Odysseus with the curse that he had considered laying on Neoptolemus. Odysseus responds by saying he will then leave with the bow and take the glory of defeating Troy for himself. Here again, Odysseus misses the point, seeing neither the bow's significance as an inheritance from the gods nor as a bond of friendship, but simply as an instrument of war. Once again, efficacy is foremost in Odysseus's mind. In a moment of real cowardice, Neoptolemus does not act counter to Odysseus's demands. Philoctetes bemoans the situation and falls into despair, as his missing bow is also his only source for food. The chorus entreats him to join the ship before it departs, insisting, "Know that it is up to you to escape death." But the difficulty of this choice for Philoctetes is understandable, for to rejoin the ship is to accede completely to his enemy's demands, to endure further humiliation, and to again make himself even more vulnerable than he was in his isolation. To return is to resume in a place in a community with other men who have treated him with little care. Philoctetes eventually expresses a wish to commit suicide, so lost is he in the sense of the inevitability of his isolation, lack of power, and his feelings of betrayal. And just as he asks for a weapon, such as a sword or an axe with which to complete the deed, Neoptolemus arrives, running and out of breath to return the bow. Instead of being given a weapon to end his own life, Philoctetes receives this weapon as a sign of power, friendship, and restoration. It restores him not only to survive, but also restores his honor. The bow takes the place of the axe. Neoptolemus defies Odysseus, insisting that the justice of this act is more significant than any strategic advantage for Troy. Even when Odysseus threatens that the entire Greek army will come after the young man if he returns the bow, Neoptolemus stands firm. Here, Neoptolemus stands in the same position to Philoctetes as Philoctetes once stood in relationship to Heracles. Philoctetes seeks to repeat history and asking Neoptolemus to end his suffering and pain. His initial choice of hurling himself into a volcano repeats this motif of death by fire. As one commentator phrases it, Philoctetes is heir not only to the bow, but to the suffering of Heracles. But Neoptolemus will not light the pyre, so to speak. Instead, his return of the bow seeks to move Philoctetes not away from, but back to the political community of the Greeks. The bow, even I was thinking this morning, I was looking at this, is kind of outward moving kind of weapon, right? It's sort of a weapon that moves one from oneself outward towards another thing intentionally. The return of the bow was not a return to stasis, but rather an acknowledgement of Philoctetes' dignity in being free to choose or not to choose to return to fight at Troy. Thus, Neoptolemus rejects both force and forceful persuasion in favor of a kind of persuasion that acknowledges Philoctetes' human freedom. But this transition back to society is not easy for Philoctetes. Neoptolemus must stop Philoctetes from shooting Odysseus. He insists that such a vengeful act will not bring Philoctetes any honor. And when he says this, Neoptolemus is acknowledging, perhaps for the first time, the possibility of honor, of a return of social status, and the importance of place in community for Philoctetes. That is, simply by stating that honor must be a concern for Philoctetes, Neoptolemus reintroduces the possibility of an orientation to the world that is not limited to victimhood or even to the place of the supplicant. He offers the exiled man something better than being a victim, something better than being rescued, which is to be returned to a moral status in the political community where his honor is up to himself again. Such a worldview also seeks to reconcile the multiple demands of nobility, piety, and political expediency, insofar as he challenges Philoctetes to willingly take up his divine task, not out of subservience to the Greeks who have harmed him, but out of a sense of his own honor and piety. Neoptolemus then offers advice well beyond his years in suggesting that Philoctetes must leave his sense of injury behind him. Of course, his feelings are understandable. After 10 years of rejection and separation, then re-experiencing the same trauma when Odysseus returns and again betrays him, how could we expect him to act differently? But Neoptolemus tells him that those who willingly wrap themselves in their pain, just like you, it is not right to excuse or to feel compassion for them. Neoptolemus cannot just mean the wounded leg, for the wound was accidental and so far incurable. Instead, the self-inflicted injury that Philoctetes continues to experience is his living in accordance with his own vision of himself as a victim of both physical, emotional, perhaps even spiritual injury. Neoptolemus lays out the facts. You will never find rest from this heavy sickness so long as the sun rises, unless you are able once again to go to the plain of Troy freely, Hakon, meet with the sons of Asclepius there, and be relieved of this sickness. In abandoning his view of himself as victim, Philoctetes does not leave behind his vulnerability or his capacity to be wounded. Indeed, his return to the war is also a return to social as well as the obvious physical vulnerability of war. So Philoctetes does not replace his vision of himself as the wounded one with a view of himself as, for example, invincible. Neither does he pretend that no wrongs have been done to him. As he mulls over the question of whether to return and embark on the ship, the question of whether to rejoin society, he expresses his fear that his vulnerability to future harm remains. He says, "It's not the pain of what's bygone that bites at me, but what is necessary to suffer from these people as I think about what is still to come." And Philoctetes is right. Not only does his return not guarantee his safety, but he's accurate about some of his comrades' deficiencies and the evils that might befall him in rejoining their company. He ought not be naive in supposing that a betrayal of trust is not a further possibility. He has experienced too much betrayal to know that it might even be likely. His deepest longing is not to go to Troy, but initially to retreat and to go home, or even to remain isolated in his own suffering. So to some extent, his vulnerability to society and the possibility of rejection begins when he leaves Lemnos and must participate again in the political, social, and military actions with those who betrayed him. Our own contemporary cultural tendency is to think about such musings about vulnerability and trust as private, as apolitical, as better suited to the realm of psychology than to the realm of politics. However, Sophocles presents Philoctetes' physical and emotional woundedness as a distinctively political problem. Neoptolemus is not merely a private friend of Philoctetes. He is a political emissary who seeks to return Philoctetes to Troy. Simultaneously, Neoptolemus stands for a somewhat traditional care for virtue as a part of politics against mere political efficacy. For example, in contrast to the false merchant, who says that either force or persuasive logoi must be used to bring Neoptolemus to Troy, Neoptolemus asks about the possibility of pothos, regret, on the part of those who abandon the man. So Neoptolemus reintroduces the possibility of a place for regret and sorrow as part of political solutions. He does not privatize Philoctetes' suffering, nor his adversaries' responses to that suffering. The play itself was produced in the midst of Athenian political turmoil. Sophocles, a friend of Pericles, a general alongside Pericles, and perhaps also Nicias, was initially a supporter of the short-lived rule of the 400, but some say perhaps disenchanted with the oligarch's rule, as well as the full democracy that emerged later. At least one commentator has suggested that among the questions present to a Sophoclean audience would be whether the younger Pericles, the son of the famous general, was worthy to lead his polis as well as his father had done. Similarly, Neoptolemus's mission here is to discover for himself his place among the Greeks as his father's son. Whether the younger Pericles would be successful in his endeavor to lead as his father had was still unknown when the play was produced. The question as to whether he possessed his father's good character was still awaiting judgment. Well, whether or not Pericles was explicitly on Sophocles' mind, Neoptolemus proves himself to be his father's son, and though perhaps more moderate than Achilles himself was. Neoptolemus insists that returning to Troy, being healed, and fighting again is really best for Philoctetes, his friend's good now being Neoptolemus' primary concern and not the bow. Philoctetes refuses until Heracles appears as a deus ex machina. While some commentators have disparaged this appearance as a contrived end to the dilemma, most have, actually, Sophocles' inclusion of Heracles, I think, is entirely appropriate to Philoctetes' emergence into society again because of the role that he had played to Heracles and how Heracles has served as a model for him. So I would like to suggest that Heracles' speech is persuasive because of the bond he shares with Philoctetes in a couple of senses. As a friend, and as the original giver of the bow, his words instill trust in the wounded man in a way that even Neoptolemus has not been able to do. But Heracles also fulfills the function of being two relationships for which Philoctetes seems to long, a father and a caring god. Philoctetes in his moments of pain most often exclaims papa or father, or even long strongs of papa papa papai, like 754 or so. Heracles appears as a strong male presence. Philoctetes has also characterized himself as hateful to the gods. He says this, for example, 254. So Heracles' presence serves as a sign that the gods who seemingly have only injured or ignored him do in fact care for his well-being. After all, Philoctetes wonders whether the decrees of the gods were just or not, 451, 452. In Heracles, he finds not only a promise of his future restoration of glory, but friendship with the gods, the presence of care. Whether or not Philoctetes' desire for justice has been fulfilled, at least his desire to know that the gods care is fulfilled in Heracles' very appearance. Moreover, Philoctetes is reminded that his story, his own life's narrative, takes on meaning in light of a larger divine narrative. To be pious is not merely to carry out the correct sacrifices or rituals, or even to obey the prophecy, but rather to understand oneself in terms of the story of the Greeks, a story with which the gods are involved. Heracles shows Philoctetes that his life's meaning is connected to a larger Greek story of victory against Troy that is yet to be told. Narrow concepts of justice as revenge or piety as obedience will not fulfill that larger divinely sanctioned narrative. Philoctetes' language in assenting to the return to Troy reveals a Sophoclean sensitivity to the relational nature of the bond with Heracles. He proclaims, "The voice much longed for you brought, you who late appeared. I will not disobey your words." And actually what it says is, it's muthois, it's not logoi, so it's, "I won't disobey like your story, I'll understand your story." Heracles is not only important because of his words, but because of his voice. That is, Heracles' voice communicates more than just words. It's more than just the content of his ideas. His voice communicates his very presence, the friendship of the gods to Philoctetes. That he also promises glory is perhaps secondary to Philoctetes' concern as to whether the gods are just and capable of friendship, a question he has raised more than once. Such friendship assures Philoctetes that the problem of justice, which he had understood as a theological problem, perhaps, are the gods just, has a positive resolution, at least in Philoctetes' own concrete and lived history. Sophocles presents the question of justice as both political and theological insofar as both concern the possibility of friendship and community between human beings, yes, but also between the divine and the human. Heracles can play this role of bridging the gap between the divine and human because he is not only a god, but also a friend. His story is also especially resonant with Philoctetes' own story. Heracles recounts his story, telling of his own deeds, labors, and eventually divine glory. However, notably absent from Heracles' tales is the story of his suffering in wearing the poisoned robe that his wife had given to him, or the intolerable pain that led him to escape from life. Surely both this betrayal by his wife and the physical suffering must resonate with Philoctetes. Indeed, they might well have been ideas on which he dwelt while on Lemnos all alone, with Heracles' bow as his only real connection to the larger world. But while Philoctetes has presumably seen the death of Heracles and understands his own assistance in that death as the key feature of Heracles' life, Heracles speaks not at all of these events. Instead, for Heracles, the greatest significance of his life lies in his deeds and his accomplishments. Betrayal and suffering were a significant reality for Heracles, but in his narrative understanding of his life after its end, they are not the main events. At the same time, Heracles is insistent that the bond that Philoctetes and Neoptolemus share is crucial to their success. Like a pair of lions, they will have to guard one another. But the source of their close bond stems from this mutual vulnerability they have experienced on Lemnos. Not only Philoctetes' multiple vulnerabilities, but also Neoptolemus' own willingness to expose his shame, his moral confusion and weakness to Philoctetes, his humility in seeking reparation rather than running away from its very possibility. Philoctetes willingly rejoins the political community with an openness to the reality of his vulnerability within it. And just as importantly, Neoptolemus rejoins that community with an understanding of the vulnerable one as he who possesses dignity and who is fundamental to the success of the community. Now, of course, we cannot forget that Heracles warns of impiety, and in some other traditions, Neoptolemus will kill quite impiously Priam on the altar at Troy. Sophocles, however, does not include this as the primary facts of his own narrative. The fragility of the care for the vulnerable becomes more central to Sophocles' own point. This event lies outside of the scope of this play's action, yet there's always this reminder that a dark edge might accompany this mostly happy ending. At the moment of their departure from Lemnos, we can see in Philoctetes and Neoptolemus that each has undertaken a journey made possible only by the presence of the other. Each has grown in new directions previously thought impossible. So while their destination is Troy and a new battle, the chorus's words of homecoming are nonetheless appropriate, as they end the play saying, "Let all of us depart together, when we have prayed to the sea nymphs to arrive safely home." Thank you.